Hey, everybody, and welcome to the doomed June chat podcast of Vassals of Kingsgrave. My name's Bina 007. I'm your host today. And the reason I think this is doomed is because Claudius the Fool, aka Greg, and I recorded a part two episode of the first book of June, which I lost in the ether, lost on the Vassal Plains. And trying to record this third part, which will hopefully cover the rest of the book, or all of the book really, with spoilers. I've tried to schedule this about 10 times and it hasn't worked. So I'm really pleased we're finally going to chat about it. I am a first time reader, not first time podcaster. I'm joined also by Kat. Kat,
hi.
We are also joined in spirit, but not in voice, by Jock Munro. Jock on the forums and listeners. Jock's, we're just wishing him all a speedy recovery from a recent op. So send him all your good vibes. And finally, last but definitely not least on this June chat, we have got June Law Master Sir Patrick the Tall.
Wow. Tall order to live up to. But yeah, I'll try. greetings, mortals. Patrick the Tall.
So we're going to basically cover all of Book 1 of June. We did cover spoiler-free the first of the three sections, but we can have a free-for-all now. We will be spoiling Book 1 of June. We probably won't try, will not try not to spoil later books in case any of you are continuing the read. Patrick may well hint at stuff that happened in the movie because he has seen it, which I find amazing because it's not out here for another couple months. So is it just out on general release in Denmark, Patrick, or do you have special Dune Law Master access to the Dune?
Well, I would like to say the latter, but it is just that Denmark always gets the movies before everyone else, really.
I know, so you got Star Wars before all of us, didn't you? Although only by a day that time rather than a whole month.
So. Yeah, so but that's just a general thing. We bribed someone, I think, and then we got movies before everyone else. And this time it was Thursday it came out.
Wow, because it's out on, I'm seeing it on special preview first week of October in the UK, but it's not out for a while. Do you want to give the listeners a little taster of how you found it?
Yeah, I can do that. It was visually and audibly a feast for the senses. I was, as a person who read the books, I was emotionally moved once or twice by the recognition of someone who has the same, you know, inner vision of things in the book, and that was really intense. It could be compared to a true lover of Lord of the Rings watching the movies for the first time,
and felt seen and heard, and more importantly, you felt the book had been seen and heard.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
there's small stuff that's been changed, like moved out in of order, or not portrayed in exactly the way that it is in the books. But I understand the changes, and it's not super important for the whole movie. So I'm very pleased. And
it's like the elves showing up at Helm's Deep. It's like it's not in the book, but it's kind of cool when it happens.
Yeah, exactly. Because without spoiling anything, they do lend more time to certain characters to actually give them their fair chance to shine in the books, shine in the movies. So that's as much as I like to say. But yes, go and watch it. I'm going to watch it again on Saturday in IMAX because I didn't watch it. Yeah, well, it's really good for a Dune fan, at least.
Well, all the reviews I've read have said exactly what you said, that it's visually stunning, costumes, effects. Denis Villeneuve obviously really is a sci-fi nerd. He gets it. He loves it. Some of them have criticized by saying because it stops only partway through book one that it misses a bit of narrative momentum. Do you feel, because it's all basically set up for the second film, do you feel that's fair criticism?
It definitely feels like the first part, and it's not you don't feel sated when you're done with the movie. You feel overwhelmed, or not overwhelmed, like you feel like you've gotten a full understanding of what this is about to become, like, or at least as much as you might know, because things does change, like, narratively in the book latter half. But
well, it also speeds up, and we'll talk about that on this podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
I felt the final kind of fifth of the book was on crack. It was so speed. It was like,
exactly,
shit, what that character's like that what?
So yeah, I could understand that criticism that it feels like nothing has really happened yet, but a lot happens. It's just that it's not so impactful for what's going to come really that much until okay. So yeah.
And then my final question, and then we'll get into the book, is one of the, not criticisms I had of the trailer, because everything I saw in the trailer, I was just like, wow, this looks absolutely amazing. The Hans Zimmer score sounds amazing, was it felt like with the Josh Brolin character, they were trying to insert a bit of maybe Iron Man type, Marvel type humor. And it's kind of weird, because all the way through when reading the book, I was like, man, this is humorless. This is so po-faced. And then seeing some of that kind of more modern humor, I was like, oh, I don't know, that now feels kind of like out of tone. So how did you find the use of humor in the film?
There was two times where there was humor, and it was basically the two things you see in the trailer. So
they're trying to sucker us in with a few jokes.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But oh, good. Well, that probably means he's respecting the tone properly then, I guess.
Yeah, it's fine. I don't think you will find it like a comedy.
Yeah, good. Okay, cool. Okay, well, thank you for that. It's really whetted my appetite even more. The whole point of me suggesting some of us who have never read the book before do it is because of that new film coming out. I love Denis Villeneuve's films, so I'm really excited. Let's get into the book. So we covered the first third in the last podcast. But we can now talk about the book as a whole. And I would like to talk about a number of things. The first one is just Dune in terms of its writing style and how it reads. And to me, it was kind of like really well written, obviously. And the world building is just stunning. I did find it lacked not necessarily humor, but maybe being grounded. And I was thinking a lot about Lord of the Rings and some of the other books I know that have amazing world building, and there are often characters that allow us into the world that are basically the human avatars. And in this, Paul is evidently unknowable, and that's the point. You know, it's almost like you're reading the Bible and this is the Messiah, so why would you understand his inner thoughts and feelings? Like, they're not going to be human. But it just felt to me like none of the characters were really that knowable. And that it's a point of the book, right? Like, many times his mum is like commenting internally that she doesn't know him and that he's gone beyond her. For me, is that a pro or con of the writing style and the way the story is framed? I guess for me, I would say if I were giving this a kind of rating, a lemon cake rating, I might just be on like 3 out of 5, because I found it such a barrier to get engaged. I felt like the person I knew most was Princess Irulan. How about you, Kat? Did you like it as a book? How would you rate it as a first-time reader? Did you find the style good?
Well, the most confusing part about it was definitely the way that it was the lack of chapters, or at least distinct chapters. That was the most frustrating part for me. So, like, unlike Martin, who does have distinct chapters, even though it's not titled chapters, you know, 2, 3, 4, etc. That was the most frustrating part for me, because I'm like, because it's just the way I'm used to reading books. But apart from that, I did enjoy it, and I do think Paul had moments of maybe not necessarily being relatable, but at least sympathetic moments. Like in the podcast for the first book, I brought up, you know, like the end of the first book ends, the end of the first third of the book is him finally mourning his father. And then there's a moment in the last third of the book where Stilgar, where he acknowledges that Stilgar has become a worshiper instead of a friend. And it, you know, it says, like, he felt, like, this overwhelming loneliness, but he can't express it because, you know, as the Messiah, why?
And in a sense, it's very thematically similar to when Danny and John are struggling with ruling in Dance with Dragons, or in the final two books of Game of Thrones, because, you know, John in particular goes through that because he does have proper mates on the wall, and then he has to become a ruler and have his former friends doubt him and his motives. And he feels that loneliness too, the loneliness of leadership. So there is.
Yeah, and also I do love Channing, and I do think she gives Paul humanity. So
Yeah, I think maybe the film's going to, or this first one's going to suffer for him not being quite in it as much yet. Patrick, how do you feel? Because you really obviously love the books. Do you think, maybe a better question for you is the style and tone of Dune Book One representative of the style of the other books, or is it very much its own thing in terms of tone?
The doubt and unknowingness will replicate itself in the other books, but with other themes and from other characters, it changes in the from the perspectives you see and who you know connect to in the stories in each book. So in that sense, it's still the same, you know, feeling. But because it's different characters, you might engage more with them than you would with Paul. Who did we have get in?
Hey, Hannah. Hey, listeners. We're joined by Hannah.
I'm just sort of listening and lurking. I'm supposed to be at work.
Okay, well, then let's get into some of the major plot beats. So effectively, after the last podcast, we'd got to the point where, you know, the trap had been laid on the Dune planet. And Paul's father had been killed in a pre-staged coup, and he had fled with his mother. He'd learnt to walk without rhythm so you don't attract the worm. And so as we start the second two parts of the book, he and his mother have to somehow be taken in by the Freemen, become their religious leaders, their prophet and religious sister, respectively. And I think there are a lot of really wonderfully written set pieces. And I think, as Hannah had predicted, the kind of the middle third of the novel was the one I enjoyed the most because it has some stunning set pieces. So I wanted to maybe just talk a little bit about those major plot beats and what they say about character and theme. And the first one I thought was the death of Liet Kynes, which on the one hand, I find a really interesting character because there's a kind of arrogance of going to a planet saying, you know, I'm not going to get these people to work, you know, with me for 500 years and change its ecology. But I found his death scene just incredibly moving. And I was thinking when I was reading it, the writing was so beautiful and evocative. And I thought, I've spent actually very few pages with this character. And yet, why am I so moved by his death? And I thought, maybe it's the nobility of his project, which in our time, contemporary time, is very resonant. And maybe it's just the writing's just that good. But I don't know, Kat, Hannah, you know, Patrick, if you reacted in the same way to that. To me, it felt really stunningly well done, I feel.
Well, I certainly mourned Liet Kynes in the sense that even when I was like 16 when I read this, 16 or 17, I felt the importance of having someone who actually understands the planet and on a geographical sense, and having that knowledge and that groundedness in what the mission should be felt like a great loss, you know, in that sense, because all the rest of it is just everyone else just thinks we need to get back at the Harkonnens, or we need to save our planet spiritually and then we'll save it otherwise and stuff like that. But this person had both perspectives, so yeah.
And it almost feels like he was beyond politics in a way, or his time span was totally different from the others. And I found that quite interesting. I felt very sad because I thought he was one of the more interesting characters. And I think there were a number of characters who died in this. I was like, what? Oh, already? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know how far he's referred to in the other books. But anyway, I just thought that was quite sad in a way. And I really enjoyed in the appendix reading about his forebears as well. That was really helpful. Kat, any thoughts on the Liet Kynes abruptly ended storyline?
Not so much, honestly. Like,
but that's okay.
I just thought of something else. As you said before, you find that Paul is difficult to, or you have difficulty to latch onto someone here because everyone is either spiritually or mentally or whatever trained to be you're more than human, basically, right? Oh. I think that's anecdotally, I think that's the way I have it with elves and dwarves in general. As I do tabletop role playing, I usually shy away from classes that or races that live long and and have different mentalities from humans in general, because that's sort of, it's more difficult to portray in a believable way, I think. I can't really, you know, immerse myself in the character. So
right. It's a good analogy, isn't it? Like somehow Galadriel is not going to be as real to us as a Aragorn.
Or Pippin, or
yeah. Yeah, Pippin's very relatable. I think that's a really good point. There is something necessarily otherworldly, but let's get into that. So this, the second big plot beat is obviously the Freeman accepting Paul and his mum into their community as a religious leader and a minister respectively, and I was wondering how far you thought either of them were conventionally religious, or is it just cynicism? And I think with Paul, it feels to me like it's not like he is religious, but as much as he is just supremely conscious that he is religion. I mean, he has this knowing, this preternatural knowing that he is a messiah, and he has to deal with the consequences of that and his visions of jihad, which I find incredibly powerful. But the mum I find really interesting because she's Bene Gesserit, but she has messed up with their breeding program. And the Bene Gesserit, I get the feeling, aren't really religious, but use religious kind of iconography to get the most out of primitive local populations. How far do you feel either of them is conventionally religious? Or I don't know. I mean, like, what do you think their relationship is to religion? I find this one of the most fascinating parts of the book.
That's definitely a very interesting question. Kat, do you want to chip in first or should I?
You can go ahead.
Okay, so if I wanted to go for Jessica, I think that she has been brought up with the dogma from the Bene Gesserit and believes in the program, believes in the idea of a Kwisatz Haderach, so much so that it's gone on for thousands of years as breeding program, and somehow.
But is the Kwisatz Haderach of itself a religious concept, or is it just a genetic,
yeah,
almost a scientific concept in a way?
Maybe, but in that sense, when it's, I think when it's so far out, like if you think the idea of a Kwisatz Haderach having that being the ultimate goal for thousands of years. It must somehow have been like dogmatic, almost religious, in a sense of we're working towards this simple, this ultimate messiah that will bring about the change. I think that's the closest you'll get to religion from either Jessica or Paul, at least.
Maybe it's like, well, that, you know, that phrase that the further ahead, like if you see a civilization eons ahead of you, everything will look like magic because the technology is so far ahead of you.
Exactly.
And maybe it's the same thing that if you believe in something, even if it's a scientific genetic process that's going to take thousands of years, at the end of the day, it just appears like religion because you kind of have to have a kind of faith that you will get there because it's so long in the future. Sorry, Hannah.
Well, I would argue that Paul has some more probably exposure to religion in this traditional sense, given his relationship with Gurney Halleck and Gurney Halleck's religion with Orange Catholicism. So he's definitely got those concepts as a guiding light in his life from a young age. But I would also offer a comparison to the Kwisatz Haderach with the prince that was promised, and various characters in A Song of Ice and Fire's attempts to bring that about. The critical difference in Dune being they do know such things are possible based on, I think it's somewhere like, I don't know, 400 or so years before Dune begins, the navigators have evolved because of the spice into these other beings that are not altogether unlike gods themselves. They're able to sort of see through space and time. And so it's a sort of religion that's based in science. And there are other elements to it, but I don't think there's the sort of delusion or, angels and demons of religions that we're familiar with. It sort of transcends that and is more rooted in a thing they can see coming because they've seen shades of it in their past and have interacted with such things.
Well, I totally agree, but I would add to that that we also here now in present day have people who believe that aliens are out there, and it's probably very likely that there are intelligent beings traveling the universe. We just haven't seen the evidence yet. So those people who work towards decrypting city signals and stuff like that, they have almost a religious fervor again towards that.
Yeah, like Chariots of the Gods or like Ridley Scott's Prometheus sort of.
Yeah.
Actually, know, what is the difference? An alien visitor to a god, would you maybe confuse the two if you were primitive?
So Jock has made an interesting point that I was thinking something similar, which is religion that is based on science sounds like Marxist-Leninism, which I think is true, like trying to find these big patterns in history that lead to a determined, inevitable conclusion. There is something similar in that, isn't there? And I was also thinking that it's something kind of, meritocratic's the wrong word because it's very engineered. But the idea of worshipping, you know, and I speak as someone who has a very complicated relationship with religion, the idea of worshipping some sort of arbitrary power who acts in quite an arbitrary manner, it's kind of like slightly bizarre, isn't it? But the idea of worshipping a man who has been bred and bred to have superior qualities of vision and skill, in a sense, does it make more sense? Or do you then slip into some awful sort of like ubermensch worship? I don't know.
Technocracy.
But I mean, in a way, do I prefer to worship rationally someone who is rationally superior and bred to that purpose? I don't know. That also sounds a little bit fascist, but I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, really, is that not similar though to how like a monarchical society works? It's a combination of breeding with a superior bloodline and then being raised to the role.
I'm not sure it's that the bloodline, like, I don't think anyone thinks King Henry VIII has a superior bloodline. It's just they think he's anointed by God. So in a way, you're not worshipping an elite. It's not because it's merit that there's something inherent in him, or maybe education.
That's what I mean, though. Like, that's what the word sovereign means, right? Like, ordained by God, you know?
Yeah, that's literally just it. Whereas Paul has, you could argue that regardless of whether he was a religious leader foretold by prophecy, that just the very nature of his far-sighted vision, his skill set, his training, that he would rise to be a leader even if it weren't foretold, you know, because that's what he's
right, it's what they say about Leto in the first book, you know, a man like that could command fanatical loyalty, you know.
I was also thinking, one of the analogies when I was thinking of, you know, Paul and Jessica joining the Freeman was an analogy to Lawrence of Arabia, who was this, you know, incredibly well-educated Brit who ends up in with Arab tribes fighting in the resistance and is treated, I don't think, like a god. I think maybe he had sometimes at points delusions of that, but and that's for another podcast. But it felt to me like I wondered if Frank Herbert had been influenced by the Lawrence of Arabia concept. And what's interesting to me in both of those is Lawrence of Arabia had deep respect for the Arabic culture and the Muslim religion. And it feels to me like Frank Herbert, when he writes, one of the things I like is he lifts a lot of Arabic words and concepts from Islam, but it seems quite respectful. It doesn't seem like he's just peppering his book with exotic or orientalist kind of words. It feels much more heartfelt than that.
Yeah, and you also need to know that, or need to think about that, when he lifted these terms like jihad and stuff, it didn't have the same meaning that it does now. So yes, I totally agree that he meant it as a homage to a very deep and you know, colorful culture that he respects a lot. They have a very they still, like, people in the Middle East have a very close connection to the land they live in. Otherwise, everything is, even now where climate is changing, it's even more important that, you know, they feel all the effects of the climate just as much as anyone else, maybe even more so. So I think that's a fair point, and I think it's very poignant and very almost like prophetic in a way, the way he brings in that aspect of it I'm not worshipping Frank Herbert, but I think it's very, very poignant, at least.
Yeah, and I think very few people do that well. And, you know, if you look at accusations, I'm not saying they're fair, of how Tolkien brings in the sort of the people from the East, the Haradrim and whatnot, and how George R. R. Martin treats the characters and cultures that he finds in the East. I feel this is a much more sensitive version, and I think the Freemen are really interesting. Like, some of my favorite parts are descriptions of their culture and the characters in that world, who I think are really admirable in some respects.
But there's also a difference, though. In Frank Herbert's Dune, it's more anthropological way, the way he inserts Paul into the culture and yes. makes him a part of it. Whilst in both Tolkien and Martin's books, we are meant to see them as a part of
other.
As other, and as a part of the middle angel culture, the way they made everything oriental.
I agree. And that also brings me back to the Lawrence of Arabia thing, right? Because he famously cast off his British army clothes and tried to become, you know, one with the tribe, which the British army hated, but he felt was essential, and it was very heartfelt. It's just a totally different level of understanding. Which brings me to one of my other really favourite set pieces after the death of Liet Kynes, which is the death of James. I don't know how we're pronouncing that. I just thought that was a ridiculously well-written scene. I normally hate the kind of hand-to-hand combat scenes in books. I don't find them that exciting. But I thought this was really well done. And also the way you feel Paul's consciousness and Jessica's consciousness of his changing consciousness during the fight. But also it was very moving, like the whole way they described the ritual of everyone sort of in the tribe acknowledging him in his death and preserving what is left of him, and the rituals around what to do with his wife and child. I found that all just, again, very moving. I was shocked at how moved I was, considering I didn't know who he was, and he was just set up in essentially to let Paul prove his leadership capability and his superiority. But and interesting to see Paul struggling, knowing he was going to have to do this, knowing he was going to have to kill James, I guess foreshadowing for all the other obligations, like whether he's going to go through with Jihad. But thoughts on this particular set piece?
Well, the whole thing where they misinterpret his reluctance to kill as him toying with him, mm-hmm. that's
interesting,
very interesting, and I think that's what really stuck with me, the idea of something that when you mean something well, when you try to act with some sort of good meaning, and that could be completely interpreted as in a wrong way, even before I knew that I liked sociology and stuff like that, anthropology, and that really was the most interesting part of basically the whole book, is the dichotomy between Paul's Western-esque ideologies and this culture that he tries to insert himself into, and how he needs to navigate both still to keep some of himself, but also, you know, be the person that his people wants him to be.
Yeah, I think that's very well said.
Yeah, then, you know, later when he just casually, I do think it's interesting that they harvest the dead for water, and that's how they, and I guess that would be how they would preserve their dead. No, I'm not entirely sure, honestly.
I just think it shows you how pivotal water is to every aspect of their life, and therefore everything of significance and meaning comes back to water. Like, if you cry for someone, gosh, you must be so moved because you're giving away your water for them, or, you know, everything comes down to water. It just shows you that desperation, doesn't it? Like, it's the most precious thing you have.
And, you know, yeah, and later on when Paul tells his mother that his 2-year-old sister is marking the dead for water extraction, and says, you know, she's doing what any good Fremen child would, or whatever it was. And Jessica is taken aback by that, but Paul says something that I found really interesting. It was isn't it funny how we never saw the line, how thin the line was between cruelty and kindness?
That's a good way of putting it.
And anyway. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so I found that part particularly interesting, and I'm sure we'll get to Elia, but I had a good time with her.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that it is a stunning, like, as you get sort of two-thirds way through the book, there's a sort of natural kind of end, almost feels like end of part two break, where you have the death of James, and then you have the in utero coming to consciousness of Alia. And I felt that really was the peak of the book. I think both of those are such interesting concepts and so well written. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite as bizarre and creepy and mind-boggling, literally, as the coming to consciousness of Alia. And the fact that, I mean, it reminded me of Star Trek. There is that Adira Tal in Star Trek Discovery, if any of you are watching, which is a species of alien where they communicate and contain prior people within them. But this was interesting because it feels like she can communicate with all previous Bene Gesserit, like, reverend mothers. I don't read that much sci-fi and fantasy, but this has to be one of the most freakishly bizarre creations of all of sci-fi fantasy literature. And I can't wait to see what happens to her, but I had real troubling imagining what she would look like wandering around as a little toddler later in the book, just like hyper conscious and wise. And I wonder how they're going to do that in the film, because I think it's weird enough reading about it. I think seeing it visualized might actually be quite, like, unintentionally laughable, because it's just so fucked up.
It's going to be Uncanny Valley. And if you've seen the last Twilight movie, that baby that they get is basically what I imagine it to be. Just in gothic Bene Gesserit clothes.
I mean, like, how do you do that without it seeming absurd? I mean, I personally feel that Denis Villeneuve's going to have to keep her off screen a lot or do something very weird. And I don't understand how she's not more powerful than Paul, because just all that accumulated knowledge.
It can't. Isn't it that she just can't do the thing that he can do? This to look into the male part.
So it's like a gendered thing. Okay.
He has the extra bit. He can look where any woman can't do, because he doesn't have because he can look into the destructive part or something like that. So I think that's the reasoning why she is very powerful within her powers, definitely. But Paul is just the messiah, so you can't do anything about that.
I'm gonna be curious if we go on with this book read, which if we do, I think other law masters probably need to take over. But, you know, it does feel quite in a time we live where we say biological sex isn't as deterministic as kind of gender identity. Like, it does feel that there's some quite strong things that are associated with biological sex in these books. And I don't know if you have a feeling or a view, Patrick, because Drew was briefly back on the forums, and he seems to be someone who's passionately attached to the Dune world. And he didn't like the fact that in the new movie, Liatt Kynes has gone from being a man to a woman, because he said that Frank Herbert very deliberately decides which biological sex people are going to be. And that if you mess with it, it messes things up. I don't know if you have a view on that either way.
I don't know. I honestly think, well, it's, I don't know if it's, I think before I went into the movie, I thought that it's fair enough to think that maybe in a mentality that's like 35 years ago, there was a more, you know, male-centric point of view on who read these kind of books and who to write to and stuff like that. And I think he did give women a fair role in the whole series, I would say. So I didn't have a problem either way. I think it didn't matter too much to me that someone was gender swapped or color swapped also, if it was. But for me, no, but in the to be honest, just saying that the actor who played it actually did a very good job, so I'm happy if it was because that person was the best to portray a character like that, then I'm completely happy with it.
Okay. Yeah, it was just kind of weird because he was getting quite hot under the collar about it. And I thought, well, I don't really know enough about the worlds of the book to know how big a deal it is. But in general, I tend to be very pro kind of like colorblind, genderblind casting and just thinking that, yeah, whoever's going to portray and bring the essence of this character to life, let's do it.
No, but it is also a very male-centric world. In the sense in that sense, I think it's fair enough to criticize that an important role like the arbiter of the change and the main ecologist of the most important planet of the Imperium might have gone to a man. That's fair enough. But for the story and for the general enjoyment for anyone who isn't like the deepest Dune nerd, I think it's fair enough to just have a good actor on on that one.
Yeah. I mean, I think my conclusion was just that it feels Frank Herbert has interesting things about to say about male and female power. And I find the Bene Gesserit absolutely fascinating insofar as they exert great power in their own space, but it's clearly a different power to the men. So, you know, I'm keen to see more of that in further books if we continue, for sure. So we get to the end of the sort of like the second part of the book with this amazing double kind of act of the death of James and then the coming to consciousness of Alia. And then it feels to me like in the final third, if not less than that, maybe the final quarter, the book just goes like just like really ramps up in speed. And suddenly we're back with Baron Harkonnen and his absolutely dipshit nephew. And then it's kind of like setting up this kind of intrigue with Count Fenring and Count Fenring's wife. He's apparently going to seduce the dipshit nephew. Then all of a sudden the dipshit nephew's dead. And then the Mentat's doing shit. And I just felt like it was like we'd have this really kind of philosophical, meditative world building set up. And then suddenly it was like, what? Wait, did he like have a maximum word count from the publisher and he just couldn't do this a bit more patiently? It was just nuts. I don't know, Kat, you read it for the first time too. Did you feel that shift in pace was jarring, or did you quite enjoy the action-packed final part of the novel?
The most interesting part of the third, of the last third of the book for me was, I did enjoy, again, Paul and Shani together. So seeing them together more. And then Alia is, I did enjoy Alia. I can't exactly put my finger on why, but I did find her interesting to say the least.
And I find people's reactions to her interesting. The fact that because she is so apparently freakish to the Freeman, they start mistrusting her. And therefore Paul and his mum, well, not so much Paul, but I like this kind of criticism or critique of how we treat people who are different, and that we can't put in an easy box, or who make us feel uneasy about ourselves. And, you know, you could say the way mainstream culture feels about mentally and physically disabled people or different people would be an interesting analogy there.
Really quick, while I have time, do you mind if I chime in about the casting with Liette?
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
So I don't have a problem with gender bending or color bending either, generally. I mean, like, I feel like, who cares? The only reason that I would think it's an issue is if they were actually going to take the time to tell this story properly, which would take like 5 movies, not one.
I think Denis Villeneuve might have that time. I mean, he could easily do this in 3 movies for all we know.
Yeah, I mean, like if they were going to do that, then I would argue it is a little bit important for Liette to be a man, just because the juxtaposition with the other female characters in the books is important to the story. The role that each woman, Chaney, Jessica, the Reverend Mother, even the shout out mates, Alia, they all, you know, Irulan even, they have this critical role to play as women. And I would just say it makes them stand out more. And I think when I read it, that's Frank Herbert's intention. And then the relationship between Paul and Chaney, it's not necessarily lamplighted in the text, but the fact that they have both recently lost fathers, they have that in common, is I think important in their relationship. And that's, you know, but it goes both ways with a woman, so it doesn't really bother me. But You know, yeah. I do think Leah is written as a man for a specific reason. And then in later books, when you get more of that history, it is a little bit more important, his male lineage and stuff. But it's not world ending either. So I don't think people should be up and about it.
Yeah, no, all good points. All good points. Yeah, and let's talk about Chani maybe a little bit before we get to this crazy ending of the book. Although, in fairness, I don't feel like I know or I'm invested in her as much as maybe Kat does. But, you know, this grim inevitability that Paul is at some point going to have to make a political marriage, maybe similar to Rob in Game of Thrones, I don't know. Like, he's not going to abandon a political marriage for Chani for love. Like, she is going to be his concubine, effectively, like his mother was. I find interesting.
Yeah, but, like, when Paul wakes up from his coma and Jessica's like, why did you drink the ceremonial water, the water of life or whatever it's called? Spice-infused water. And, I got that backwards. Chani blurts out that that's what he did. And Jessica's like, why would you do such a thing? And Chani says, well, he is your son. And Paul, and you know, it says like a rare, warm, genuine smile crosses Paul's lips. And he's like, here, mother. Or he's like, and he says, listen to my beloved mother. She knows. That was one of the few genuine moments of actual comedy, too, I feel like.
Yeah, and I am curious to see more of the relationship between Jessica and Chani as well, these two important women in his lives who are more or less sort of like nervous and skeptical about what he's becoming and what he's doing. I think that's a really interesting dynamic.
And, you know, he does say to Chani that the princess has nothing but his name, so has nothing but the Atreides' name and, you know, anything resembling affection.
Yeah. Thoughts, Patrick, on the Chani Jessica relationship or the Paul Chani relationship?
Okay. Yeah. It's difficult because it's interesting and it's sort of, you know, that it's not, it's the idea when you read it the first time, you know that it's obviously not the best choice for him in the political mindset. He should definitely marry the and focus on having, you know, emperor children and stuff like that, but he chooses to follow his heart and his premonitions with Chani. So that's, it makes it interesting to see what that choice to stick with a possible outcome that could be good, but still, you know, we know that it has you know, tragic effects with the death of his son. So in that sense, I think I like Chani for the perspective of having a more grounded person as a person close to him that is not, that both, you know, worships him a little, maybe at least knows of all the things and have been implanted with all the religion that Paul has been, you know, preempted with, but is one of the reasons why he will not be accepted as much by the greater Lanzarote and stuff like that, because she's nothing for anyone else than him. And that's really important for me in the idea of how the story will evolve. So
I think it's important though for him to have that relationship with her, though. I mean, she's a Sayyidina. She is sort of, excuse me, exalted in the Fremen culture. So they make a good pairing as far as him becoming a more imperial rule from Arrakis. He sort of has his hand, you know, playing in both sides then. So to not discard her either and to have heirs with her is important with the relationship with the Fremen and the people of Arrakis.
Definitely. And I totally agree. But I also, it's, again, if you look at real history or like real society, if someone was like, if a culture was seen as primitive or almost non-existent, and this person that's supposed to, that comes with a lot of power, chooses someone from there to mate with or to become a power couple with, that would not add as much prestige as if the person went back to the culture that they also want to rule and chose a suitable mate from there. I think it's a very good point, and something that he it's just well thought out, that whole dynamic there.
Yeah, I see that. And the other thing, isn't Tynes was born in the Imperium, wasn't he? I'm not entirely clear on that, even from the appendices on him. I thought he was of the Imperium, so, but maybe not. I'm not entirely sure on that front.
I think he is appointed from the Imperium, so most likely he's from another planet.
Yeah. So Tani was raised Fremen, unlike Paul, which was her point when they were trying to figure out why Paul was in his coma. That's why she suggested that maybe he was having an allergic reaction to the holy water, for lack of a better term. And the other thing, too, is, mind you, Paul is still a teenager, so I think the fact that he immediately falls for this girl is another kind of window into how human he can be.
Yeah, it's very Robb Stark of him, yeah. Really.
Well, it's very exactly. Teenage boy who's hurting because his whole world's been turned upside down, and no matter how much Jedi training you have from the point of birth, and no matter how you've been bred to be a Superman, maybe it's still nice to like make out with a girl who's hurting like you because her dad just died and feel some human connection, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, while there's a break, I'll say goodbye. I'm back to the theater now. Bye, guys.
Okay, so maybe we should pivot to that final third and get to the bad guys. And is it a fault in this book that the bad... I mean, okay, there are more ambiguous characters, but Baron Harkonnen's pretty unredeemable, right? As is his dipshit nephew.
Yeah.
Which nephew are you referring to?
Both.
His heir or...
Both. I mean, there's the one that he sets up as a patsy, who he knows is incompetent. And then there's Fade Rauther that he thinks is going to be his actual heir, but is also basically just a meathead arsehole. So...
Yeah.
The whole family is pretty unredeemable, right? Irredeemable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the characters I found more interesting were Count and Lady Fenring. Unless you want to say interesting things about the Harkonnens, Patrick. Like, are there reasons why I'm being too dismissive and why I should not be so dismissive?
Nope, it's completely fair. they're exactly what they're meant to be.
Okay.
Not the right choice for any rule, really.
Exactly. And I'm surprised that the Badger Emperor kind of kept them around as long as he did. But you do have Count Lady Fenring. Am I making them out to be more interesting than they are, Patrick? Because they struck me as a little bit interesting.
I don't have the same relationship as you do. So I would say that... Can you explain what makes them interesting for you?
Well, I like the idea. I like power couples. I find couples who are both kind of similarly aligned and ambitious quite interesting. And I like the idea that... because they basically agree that she's going to try and seduce Fade Rauther. So I find that quite almost Lannister-ish. Like, it's quite cynical. And I don't really understand to what end, but I find it interesting. But it didn't really seem like anything was going to come of that now, because in the final kind of 30 pages, that whole plot subplot got wrapped up pretty quickly. So I don't know.
Yeah.
It felt like it was the most approximating to a Game of Thrones style cynical power play, like conventional cynical power play, as opposed to all the stuff on Arrakis, which is much more kind of religious, spiritual, philosophical. If that makes sense.
Yeah, but that's the thing. The point is that it's supposed to feel like the Lansrad and all the dukes and barons and whatever, they're playing their game, but it's not the game that should be played right now, because there is a jihad coming and they don't fucking care about the game of planets and thrones.
Yeah, I mean, it literally felt like, you know, when all the people from Night's Watch are sort of sending dead hands and trying to persuade the Lannisters to kind of send reinforcements, and no one gives a shit. And like, there's vague mutterings of Muad'Dib and maybe Paul Silver, no one cares. And you're just like, there's this entire jihad on your doorstep and you guys are worried about seducing like some baron's nephew to get some power points. It's all a bit laughable, really.
Yeah, and that's what I think, that's the whole point of it. I think, yeah. You have these, they might be good at, you know, governing a place, like Baron Harkonnen is definitely good at squeezing money out of planets, for sure.
Mm.
Raban, not so much. But those skills are not applicable to the situation that is coming. and that's just how he juxtapositions where they came from and what the game that was played that put them there, and what came out of it, really.
Canely. Though that is another interesting aspect, the idea of Canely, like, and how it was brought about to minimize collateral damage, if you will. Just wars between houses being fought strictly with, pretty strictly with poison. Yeah, I'm looking it up right now.
This is, I think, what's the main thing that George R. R. Martin brought into the whole story is this idea that there's two different things happening, and the idea that in the Landsrad and whatever they do one thing, and what's happening is requires completely different skills. that's the theme that I also, you know, that a lot of people are attracted to in Game of Thrones, that you start up seeing that there are weird stuff happening, and then you find out that nobody really cares.
You know, the next book, Patrick, does that just sort of just pick up where this one stopped, or is there a big gap or a big change in perspective?
It's not that big of a, like, yeah, years, but it's the same problems are inherited into the next books. Let's just say it like that, that people are still, you know, trying to figure out what to do with this guy who basically controls the whole empire, but, you know, is not the original emperor, so... They found out that somehow, you know, they don't have as much power anymore, and that's and that's a problem for them.
I agree.
So that's basically a problem that has to be solved somehow.
Okay. Do either of you have anything else to say on this first book?
I did find I'm totally mispronouncing that. Jamis's wife.
Oh, yes, she was interesting. Or that whole moral conundrum. What do you do with a wife who offers herself to you as a concubine?
Or just basically a household servant,
Either way, it's weird, isn't it? Why would you want to have someone around who was the wife of the guy you killed, just reminding you of your guilt the whole time? I don't know.
I do find that her dedication to Elia, you know, how she almost felt like a second mother to Elia.
Yeah, she found her own position in the whole thing. I liked her and liked the idea of it. And also, is it Sitting Bull? Or not, I'm not sure. There was the movie with Dustin Hoffman where he ends up getting adopted by a Native American tribe. That's a movie. And it's actually quite good because, or at least it reminded me a lot of this in the sense that there's a responsibility for the family that you affect, and somehow you have to take care of the rest of whoever you affect, who you become intertwined with. It felt authentic, but also different from what we normally would think was normal.
I'm now on IMDb Pro trying to find this film.
I am 80% sure that was Dustin Hoffman.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything you'd like to round out talking about the film about, Patrick? Film, book, I mean.
Or either.
I guess the whole idea of seeding religion into an area to control it is a very poignant theme, I think, that one might explore in a sense that religion could be maybe the most extreme or way of doing it, but you... have in recent years also seen examples of people, of nations, you know, seeding ideas into a nation before, you know, stepping in and trying to, you know, take them over or exploit for resources and stuff like that. I think that is a very, very intelligent perspective in 1975, as it was written.
62, actually.
Oh yeah, 65. 60. Okay, 65. Sorry, I was thinking about the Children of Dune. And you have that part of it from the Bene Gesserit, but you also have a ecologist that should it should have been the goal of everyone to, you know, transform it to be a habitable planet and all that sort of stuff. But then you also have the Imperium and the Spacing Guild, that they really don't want the planet to be transformed, because they know that will affect their resource, the most important resource in the whole, you know, galaxy, Imperium. Mm-hmm. So those ideas that money comes before, positive change, and another person, another group, faction can have a completely different idea of what they want out of this, and work against it and see these things, these different factions working and looking at it and, you know, you just them working against each other in that way begets this stalemate that is ripe for, you know, revolution and stuff. It's just very, very clever, very intelligently written and thought out.
Like how the Bene Gesserit are referred to as witches.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a very, it's an interesting commentary on how society has always termed women who somehow managed to increase some power and wisdom. You know, let's try and make them feel like other and sinister because we can't handle it. I love it. I find the concept of the Bene Gesserit one of the coolest in the whole book, I have to say.
Yeah, they're definitely one of the coolest things, also because they are the most important power in the universe, in the solar system, in the Imperium.
It's all very Battlestar Galactica, actually, so there's another crossover podcast waiting to happen. I think that's in a way maybe why I'm a bit frustrated. I mean, not frustrated, there's so much I really enjoyed in this book, but on the other hand, stuff that I found really frustrating. And I really ended the book on a bit of a low. I was on this real high during the sort of death of Jarms and birth of Ahdi a bit, and then by the end I was just like, I don't know if I want to continue, because I don't know if there's any characters I actually engage with. I don't really feel like this whole eco philosophy religious book is for me, and I still feel kind of like a little bit on the fence, and I don't know, like, for me the mission is complete because I've read the book before the movie, and I don't know if any of the lore masters want to continue on with a reread, but for me I think I need maybe to watch the film and get a bit jazzed up to continue on, which is a shame. It's such a like epic book in the kind of the peripheral vision of anyone who reads anything sci-fi or fantasy.
And I
almost feel a little bit not let down by it, because it's just so monumental. I mean, so many of the concepts, like most sci-fi books or fantasy books would be happy to create a concept like the Bene Gesserit, or a concept like spice, or a concept like the Mentat, you know, like that it just throws things at you that you're like, my god, this is just phenomenal. And yet I was just looking for a more emotional hook to get into it. Do you think I'll get that in the next book if I continue, or do you think it's going to be more of the same and I'm still going to feel frustrated?
It's really difficult. Depends on who you latch on to, really. What kind of character you can latch on to, because there's going to be more insight that is slightly more human-esque, but it's...
Well, maybe that'll help, yeah.
But it's still, you know, it's still unknowing, mystic sort of shenanigans that they're up to.
Mystic shenanigans piss me off. So, Kat, do you think you'll continue with the books? Did you enjoy the first one? Maybe you've already read it, because, I mean, you read the first one in, like, one sitting, practically, so maybe I'm behind.
I'm not entirely sure. It will depend if we decide as a group. And I actually don't know if my dad has the other books either. So he probably does. But
I love the idea of leaving it to the fates, though. Like, if your dad has a copy of the book, I'll get one and we'll read it. And if he doesn't, I'll leave it until we get there in the films. Yeah. Let's throw it to chance. I love it. Well, thank you, Kat, for bearing with me as I try to schedule and reschedule this. And thank you, Patrick, for joining us. I think it's, and also Hannah, I think it's really important to get a bit of context from people who know the whole series is really, really useful. Jock, thank you for bearing with us and your incisive comment. Can't wait to properly podcast with you again. And thank you so much, Patrick, for jumping on. Kat, always a pleasure. And let's speak soon. Bye, guys.